This is the Technology Advisory Professionals Technology Innovation and Growth Podcast, the podcast dedicated to supporting business leaders and entrepreneurs in choosing technology, finding innovation, and achieving growth. For more information, contact us at podcast@tapintotech.com. Enjoy this week's episode.
Today's episode is data-driven decisions. It's what the cool kids are doing. We're back today with two friends of the podcast and smart individuals in their own rights, Dr. Sean McRae, a Calgarian who somehow found Cleveland attractive, but is working to bring more data analytics into medicine and the paramedical industry, and Rodney Frank, another Calgarian who resisted the siren song of the Cuyahoga and practices architecture and guiding businesses into value spending of their technology dollars. Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Very well.
Excellent. Excellent. So data-driven decisions is a bit of a buzzword, and in many industries, it's a focus right now. And there's so much to talk about that regarding this. We're just going to dip our toe in the surface of this whole thing. So most people don't understand that there's a difference between data analytics and business analytics. And I'd like to start just by, on a very high level, defining the difference between business analytics and data analytics, if we can. So with that, I am pulling up something on the internet, but with that, I'll go to Mr. Sean McRae, because he's got a real interest in data analytics right now.
Sure. I mean, with data, it's important to, I think we've talked about this in our conversations before amongst the three of us, you know, understanding what you want to get out of the information or the data that you have. You have to have a predefined sort of 5 to 7 points that you really, really want to understand in order to be able to get solid information out. You can't just take a software and, you know, kind of hit the filter all button, if you will, or download every little bit of information, because then you're gonna drown. You're gonna have too much information from it.
Right.
So I mean, it's important to really pare it down.
Right. So if we separate out the data and for the layman, you're focused on that data analytics piece and that whole get the data that's required
sure.
that provides you insight versus the business analytics with now I've got the data, what do I do to massage that into some sort of something that makes sense for my business.
Sure.
So you interact in a large part with large insurance providers, technical medicine, mm-hmm. and again with small just providers, right?
Sure.
End providers. So on those three different levels, is there value for data and business analytics at all three of those levels?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So here's a good example, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, but I think this is a good example. So here in the US, what the insurance companies have mandated, and they did this a few years back, was if you turn around and you present your primary care with back pain, let's say, you know, whatever, you're out exercising or gardening or whatever, you woke up the next day, you have back pain, you go to your primary care and your primary care says, let's go have an MRI. You go have the MRI, it comes back and it turns out that you've herniated a disc. However you did it, right? And now you're complaining about back pain. And so your primary care, let's pretend, thinks that this herniated disc is significant enough to warrant a spinal surgery, some sort of either open or endoscopic, doesn't really matter. before you can go and have that surgery, right, by whatever surgeon you want to have it with, before you can have that surgery, you have to go through conservative care. So you either have to have chiropractic care, physical therapy, you have to go and see a physiatrist or any blend of all of them or two of them, right? So you have to do a significant portion of conservative care and prove to the insurance company that it's failed before they're going to pay for your surgery. And the reason why is because the insurance company turned around and they mined a bunch of data that told them that if we go and take a PT, DC, or PM&R route, meaning a physical therapist, a chiropractor, or a physiatrist, a pain management doctor route, we're going to get a significant portion of these people better rather than, and that's going to save us from having to shell out $150,000, $200,000 to have this spine surgery, right? And then all of the subsequent issues that come down the road for the rest of their lives, right? So they took that information that they mined, the data analytics told them, hey, if you don't pay for the surgery, if you make them do the conservative care first, you're going to get out of having to pay for the surgery. That data that they got told them to change their business model, right? So they used that information that through the data analytics that they obtained, and then they changed their business analytics to be more preventative and less, okay, we'll let the American Medical Association sort of run the show. They said, we've got the gold, we're going to make the rules, and now this is what it looks like, whether you like it or not.
Right. Right. The U.S. profit motive is always there, right?
Right. It's always, you know, they're always flying that great big green $1 flag, right? It doesn't matter where you are or what you're doing. They're always comes down to the dollar.
Right. Right. So when you look at the data on X piece, and it's for big businesses such as those insurance providers, they have I'm sure they have teams of people just looking at, like, actuarials who are just looking at what does this data mean for me?
For sure.
For the small practitioners, is there a way that business analytics can help them? Like, how can they benefit, if they can at all, benefit from understanding the data that they're seeing or they get, and then changes they could make in their business?
Sure. And when you went as a provider, you can go to coding classes, basically, is what they're called, right? So you get patients in, you figure out, you know, you come up with their diagnosis and the differential diagnoses, and then you code them. But so you treat them for that, and then you have to submit your bill, right? Your super bill to these insurance companies, and there's specific codes. And these classes effectively mine data from the insurance company based on nothing more than what the insurance company's paying for and how much they're paying for said service, right? So they may tell you, don't put a 1234, that's not a real code, but a 1234 code down. You don't do that because you only get 10 cents, let's say. Put down a 3456 code, you know, with a modifier on it, and then you get 15 cents, right? So once you start to figure it, and it's really you're using technology more to play the game rather than to help the person. And it takes a lot of back end time.
So that from some, and I'll speak from a complete point of not knowing any of this, but that seems like walking a fine line between gaming the system and being doing something.
Sure. No, you absolutely, you have to make sure that all your notes are above board, and that, you know, it is, you know, you're doing what you say you're doing for the benefit of the patient, because I promise you, dollars to donuts, every insurance company at one point in time is going to audit your billing and ask for your notes. And if they don't mesh up, if they're not copacetic, then they're just going to come in and say, yeah, you really, you owe us some money and we want it now.
Right. Right. And do you, is this, are these data sets open to public? Can a public view any of these data sets and look at the correlations that, that they've made, or is this all behind the scenes type of thing?
There's a lot of it that's just behind the scenes. Like, you know, MedMute, like, for example, there's insurance companies called like Medical Mutual or United Healthcare, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, all these companies, they take the United States and they cut it into quarters. So they have a Northwest, a Northeast, a Southeast, a Southwest, and they basically regionalize the entire country. And over time, they've determined what practitioners in each specialty in each region will find as an acceptable reimbursement for said procedure. So if you go to your doctor in Orlando, Florida, let's say, for a cough, right? And he looks at you, listens to your heart and lungs, and, oh, you're fine, here's something. And then you go to Los Angeles, California for the exact same thing. Those two physicians could be getting different reimbursement rates. And it's all because the insurance companies have determined that these are acceptable rates based on the information that they've gathered.
Hmm. So if you're a practitioner, if you're that doctor who's then providing the service, you wouldn't have insight into, do you have insight into?
Absolutely. They tell you up front. They're so brazen. They're so, we run the show, right? It is so much arrogance by the insurance company of, we run the show, we control healthcare, we have the gold, so we make the rules, that they tell you up front, they give you a list of reimbursement rates. So they say, if you do a 123 code, this is what you get. You can charge us $10 million, but we're going to give you $5, let's say. And that's all you'll get, no matter what.
So if you're a practitioner, is it theoretically possible for you to go, well, I'm seeing this trend in my business, like I'm seeing these people coming in.
Sure.
I'm then going to take what I understand of these people and focus my practice just on these people.
Absolutely. And it happens all the time. Concierge, it's nicknamed concierge medicine. It's a big sort of thing here.
Right.
And it's exactly that. It's called concierge medicine. And it effectively embodies multiple physicians from different specialties. They go into a group and they charge you X amount of dollars for their concierge services a year, and they bill out your insurance as well. So that almost membership, if you will, allows you to have more ready access, meaning they can call you in the middle of the night and say, my toe really hurts. What do you think? You know, well, you've got gout, stop drinking red wine and eating red meat. You know what I mean? And don't ever call me again, type of thing, you know, or, you know, our C-suite, whoever needs his or her annual physical for their insurance policy that's being renewed tomorrow, get up here and get it done. Okay. You know, because there's a large dollar amount tied to that concierge service. And if you start to do concierge services, you don't fall victim to the highs and the lows of the calendar year, meaning you have peaks. So classically here in the United States, probably not so much in Canada, but classically in the United States, there is a higher amount of patient visits closer to the end of the year, in the second half of the year. So Q's three and four, there's more patients that come versus Q's one and two. And the reason why is because people have generally met their deductible by the end of Q2. So they roll into Q3 and four and they basically just owe a copay plus whatever percentage they have to pay for the visit. But in Q's one and two, they haven't met their deductible. They still have their copay and they got to pony up a lot more money up front. So people are less inclined to go in the first two quarters than the last two quarters. And we know that, right?
So the concierge service is really just a nice way. You sell a club membership. They flatten their revenue curve throughout the year.
Correct.
And then they get all the upside on the back end with that.
Yeah.
We actually have a similar system in Alberta for that. It's called the primary care networks. And we don't have any of those impetuses that you talked about that are, you know, the seasonality, the co-pays, the meeting the deductibles, anything like that. But they've started looking at a very similar system here where doctors get paid a certain flat rate for just having you as a patient. And you have to subscribe that this is where you're going to go as your primary care physician. And then they can flatten out that curve where it's not, you know, you get paid every time you visit. It's just you should visit your doctor more often. And that's why they introduced it, is just so that people aren't hesitant to go and only go when they're on their deathbed. They'll go more often, you know, because they don't have to worry about it. It's not going to impact the system anymore because you're now part of this primary care network. So when you have a sniffle, you call your doctor. When you have a cough, you call your doctor. You don't just kind of ride it out and go. But interesting that similar system, but not the same impetus.
Right. And you know, it's interesting that you say that they're bringing that over, because when I lived in Europe, I lived in the Netherlands back in 2007, and they had that exact system. So what it would be is a physician would get paid per patient by the government for the entire year. And they would cap the number of patients that physician could have. And that's the money that they would make. And people would never doctor shop, right? Like here it happens all the time. Oh, I didn't like the color of his tie, I'm going to go somewhere else, right? There it was, you know, you saw your doctor and that was your doctor for life. And that individual just got basically paid. And in other European countries, what they also do is they sort of throw in a little bit of a bonus, in the sense that if your patients are healthier, right, on the whole, if they're healthier, meaning they only come in for the sort of the bare minimum number of visits, it saves the system money. So instead of discouraging that, you know, we end up ultimately paying you a little bit of a bonus for keeping your patients healthier and saving the system as a whole money.
Wager a guess that that's probably what's happening with those primary care networks, because that would make a heck of a lot of sense given our dynamic versus the American dynamic.
Yeah, and it's brilliant, right? Because what is the point of healthcare, right? It's not to manage the patient in hospice when they have pancreatic cancer, like end stage pancreatic cancer. It's to prevent the person from ending up in hospice with end stage pancreatic cancer, right? It's less expensive, right, to keep the population healthy. But on the other side of the coin, for pharmaceutical companies and private insurance companies and things like that, that make you sort of pay to play, if you will, because that's what private insurance does. The more comorbidities or past history you have, the bigger your premium, right? Then it's more profitable for them, because you know you have to pay to get the drugs and to stay alive.
So what I'm hearing out of that is like the data analytics portion of that is what's deciding, you know all the different data points that are necessary for the US versus for Finland versus for Canada in these different scenarios. That's your data analytics. Mm-hmm. And then your business analytics on top of that now is, okay, well, based on all of that, you know, should I be ordering X amount of, you know, cotton swabs and X number of blankets and X number of, you know, medications to kind of layer on top of that system to make my business more efficient?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You can absolutely gain all sorts of, we'll loosely call it healthcare benefit out of the information that they mine. Right. Like the US bought 100 million doses of COVID vaccine that they don't even know if it works yet. They've already committed to 100 million doses of it. They have no idea if it even works. They have no idea what the long term effects are. But you know what? Big pharma, these companies that are in the race to win it, have already said, OK, so we're going to have, it's a pandemic. So if we can make this work, then this is our projected or our potential data that we'll get out of this. And they've already started to change their model based on this potential data, the potential ROI.
Right. So with that being the case, and I kind of want to, because we can go down a huge rabbit hole, especially in healthcare, because they have such massive actuarial tables. They have such precise data that they can get pretty specific correlations on. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of switch gears and go into the kind of the small medium space where they don't have that level of data, or maybe they have a significant amount of data, but they don't know they have that data.
Right.
And they want to start getting into that business analytics piece with the data they have and avoid, and this is kind of my go-to website when I talk about business analytics with business people, is to stay away from the spurious correlations. Like if you do a Google search on spurious correlations, there's a website devoted to this. I happen to be looking at a correlation right now that matches quite nicely in the number of people who drown by falling into a pool correlates almost perfectly with films Nicolas Cage appears in. So, I mean, the correlation is there. It's correlated for sure. But if you're a business owner, you probably want to understand your correlation or be really selective about the data you're introducing in. And what I guess I want to ask is, what are some key systems? I'm going to ask Rodney, key systems that companies can leverage to get some of this data? And do they even need these systems, or are there low cost alternatives to kind of get this type of data?
Well, I think, you know, it's really truly about knowing your business, knowing what is important to you and where you're trying to get things again. I'm gonna bring that point back up in the sense that, you know, a company that I worked with that owned a fleet of trucks, they were spending an inordinate amount of money on oil changes, believe it or not, because they would find that the trucks go beyond certain specifications. And when they hit these different periods of activity, the frequency of the oil change needed to change, and the type of lubricant that they were using also was impacted. And what they were finding was that as soon as they hit sort of these thresholds, and it was just from them starting to sort of be curious about, you know, a particular data point, they started noticing that there was sort of a defined limit of when they hit this point, then all of a sudden maintenance becomes a lot more expensive on the vehicle. And so they went down this path of deciding whether or not it was worthwhile to put devices onto these vehicles that would basically just read all the sensor data and kind of advise them when they're hitting this threshold, instead of kind of passively sitting back and you know, seeing it in the data and kind of wondering, you know, how can we manually do this? Do we get somebody to update a logbook? Do we, you know, how do we figure this out? They threw some sensors on their vehicles, and then now basically once every certain 3,250 cycles of whatever it was, they'd get an email threshold warning saying, hey, you need to bring this vehicle in within the next 2-week period to avoid the extreme maintenance cost coming up. And so it really started them down an adventure into IoT almost, where they were looking at devices that they could attach and extra sensors that they could put on their equipment to kind of get that in investment sorted. It's difficult
just,
to know.
Let me just pause you for a second. For the uninitiated, IoT being the Internet of Things, which is also another buzzword that we will touch upon. I've got some people to talk about the Internet of Things. Many business leaders have heard about it, kind of like blockchain. Let's do the IoT, or let's do the blockchain, but it's a complicated thing. Anyway, so back to where you were.
Yeah, sorry. And that's sort of part of the, you know, the conversation is, you know, when is it right to look at IoT as a thing, right? And when do I cross that threshold into knowing that I need more data in order to be able to make these business decisions? So, you know, when you look at a small business, they may be just as simple as producing widgets. There may not be a whole lot of data that's important to them, other than, you know, I'm selling this many of them. There's this much demand. But as you start to know and understand your business better, you start to understand the data points that are actually going to impact you. Maybe it's not data inside your company that's important, and maybe you need to start looking outside your company for that data. And so it really is a decision that, as a business decision maker, you need to kind of be aware of the environment around you. You kind of have to have a little bit of a third eye towards this environment outside of your organization to be able to get there. And those triggers, you know, when you start to see those patterns and you start to realize there might be a data point out there, you have to figure out, how do I now move in that direction? How do I get information from that? And again, you can kind of work with your providers to figure out, okay, this is my business problem now. I'm seeing that there's a trend over here, but I don't know how to get more information on that.
Sure.
You know, build those data pipelines so that you can actually get that stuff coming back into your system and you can make those decisions on it.
Sure. One of the industries that I think could definitely make most use, and many companies are, but it's such a Wild West industry. And Sean, you'll laugh as soon as I say this, but that companies that don't leverage business or data analytics that should are restaurants. Restaurants.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Restaurants are possibly the most easy win for data analytics and business analytics. What are you selling? Sure. When are you selling it? How much are you selling it for? How many people are you employing to do it? That type of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I ask about tools, do you need a complex tool? My question is, could you just use something like Excel to do this?
And for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I would suggest yes, but.
Yeah, you know, you look at the simplistic form of that. What's the right sensor for this data? Well, it just might be a staff member putting a one on a little sheet that you've written up for them at the front desk to say, yep, person came in, person went out, average time of visit, you know, when did they clock in, when did they clock out? You know, it could be that simple for your sensor. You know, all the way up to, you know, from some of our previous conversations on things like how much is too much. You know, it could be a sensor on the door that's watching the emotion on their face and is determining, yeah, that's the same guy that just came in an hour ago and he's leaving less satisfied now than he was before when he came in. Like, sure, you go to that level of extremity, but
spoken like a true technophile right there. let's scan people's faces to see the change in their smile.
Well, or their gait, or how quickly they're leaving. Like, right. Yeah,
he walked in but ran out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So those are, you know, ultimately that's the extreme you could go to, is that sort of level of profiling of people coming in and out of your establishment. But think about all the space in between, right? So there's somewhere that's going to be a comfortable threshold as a business leader that says, you know, this is the right level of tracking or data that I want to capture for my business. And then, you know, working to figure out what are those right sensor inputs to that. You know, is it as simple as somebody checking a box when somebody comes in and checking a box when they leave? You know, does it need to be more complex, like maybe just a door sensor that senses when the door is opening and closing? You know, things like that. Or do you need a combination of those things to bring it together to actually get the data points you're looking for? And you need to be willing to spend a little money in that situation, but do it experimentally, grow it, you know, make it bigger, and until it gets to that level that you're looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think, Rodney, growing it based on need is exactly, I mean, I think that's exactly what people don't realize, right? Like, they don't realize that they should just grow it as they need it, not just try to jump right to the peak of it.
You bet.
Well, because, again, there are more than enough people who are willing to sell you a really great solution for hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, you know, just, you know, as a random example, if we use Aunt May's pie shop, we'll say, you know, just keeping a spreadsheet of, I sold these pies today and these are the pies I genuinely sell on a daily basis, and keeping that count, you know, is great. And then at least you've got some sort of data and business analytics, because you can see, look, I'm selling 17 cherry pies a day and I'm selling, you know, 14 apple pies, but I'm only selling two peach pies. Maybe I shouldn't focus so much time on peach pies. Maybe apple and cherry are the way to go. And, you know, further to that conversation, for people who are just in that small business scenario, there are tools out there, and, you know, you guys can jump off on that, but there are tools out there that will look even deeper and say, okay, you've got this much data. You know, we've looked at 30 days of your data. Now we can predict with some accuracy, you know, on Mondays, you sell 17 apple pies. On Wednesdays, you sell 10 apple pies, but 12 peach pies. I mean, things like that. So you can get a view.
Well, and once you get to stable, that's when you look for what's your next jump off point, right? So you've done the analytics on what you're selling today, you know, given all the variables of, you know, who you're using as a supplier, you know, what's the quality of their product, all that kind of stuff. And then maybe now you're looking to go back and figure out, like, why weren't my peach pies selling? Was it because I was using this peach provider instead of that peach provider? Is it because peaches in my area generally just aren't that good? You know, people's taste buds are different because it's regional, you know, cuisine, that kind of thing. So, what is build that core, build that piece you want to start with, and then, you know, start to figure out what the next layer out is to build that business analytic to where you need it to be.
Yeah. And you know, I think more to, and also to touch on Rodney's point earlier as well, earlier in our conversations, was I think what we don't realize with individuals that don't or aren't savvy as far as data and that type of analytics goes is they get fatigued, right? They get acronym fatigue. Nobody cares about a TCP/IP anymore. You know what I mean? They just go, whatever, dude, am I going to be able to get my email? You know what I mean? And yeah. So then they go, oh, well, I'm allowed to have $2 million to go and play with to buy my Ferrari. Well, I don't want to have to upgrade my Honda to whatever. Right. And over time, I'm just going to buy the greatest and latest. And then I don't have to worry about it for two more years. And I don't get that fatigue. Right. So it really kind of takes things off your plate. And I think from an IT perspective, if you go into these facilities and say, you know, you don't need this monster of a thing, this $2 million monster, we can start you off at the $500,000 medium size item and then progressively build you up, but we won't go over that $2 million threshold, and we'll put this on our own plate. We'll take responsibility for this. You know, not only, in my opinion, not only would you have a more solid long-term relationship because you're doing something for these people, but you're also ensuring that you've sort of, flattened the curve of the potential drop off of business, right? Because now these people are like, hey, wait a minute, he could have, but he didn't. And now he's going to take care of us. And he's really the expert. And I just, you know, I'm here in HR, so I'm going to hire and fire and train. And you know what I mean? And yeah. So if you really start to be willing to bring that responsibility in-house, I think you'd really get a lot better response right. from these people, right?
Yeah.
And also analytically, the apple pie for multiple people is the hottest seller. But if you go into smaller pies, then it drops down the order.
Right.
Because they did actually do a study on that. I don't know who got, I wanted that job, but I didn't get it.
So absolutely. I will be the apple guy, apple pie guy all day, yeah. All day long.
Right.
A la mode. Let's do that.
Like,
let's
exactly. Do that. Like how I don't understand how these guys get, like, I mean, I don't want the, you know, reconstituting job. I want the apple pie job.
maybe we'll talk about the reconstituting job on a future podcast. But that was a side conversation that went south quickly.
Yeah.
I like that data fatigue piece, because I think that is another thing that small customers specifically start to get overwhelmed by data pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And just to touch on it, I think you can't underestimate the importance of visualization, meaning you can show people here's all the numbers and they'll go, great.
Yeah.
But I'm a visual guy. Show me graphs, show me charts that show the stuff. And I, you know, getting in, I don't know if you guys have used products like Tableau or used products like Power BI, or even just in Excel. Excel is a very powerful tool that most small businesses should take more advantage of, but that data visualization piece.
Well, and it's an important thing for IT providers to understand too, is that a lot of times they are just looking for, you know, this to just be a decision I don't have to make. And that that decision fatigue or that data fatigue can really be a struggling point. So overloading them with those techie terms like the TCP/IPs and the IoTs and the clouds and all of this kind of stuff, right? It's just adding to the frustration instead of solving their problem. And so, you know, taking that step back, drawing the picture, saying, you know, this is what I heard. It kind of looks like this, you know, versus just numbers and buzzwords and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It makes sense to people when they start to see the graphs or they start to see the pictures. It helps them understand that you know what they're looking for. It helps you make that 100%. Match again.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, like how many meetings have you guys gone into where you try to explain this, the tech world, right? And 2-3 minutes in, it's just glazed donuts all over the place for eyes, right? And people don't want to look stupid, especially in front of their colleagues. So you say, anybody got any questions? Well, you couldn't force a hand up if you wanted to, right? Because people, A, they're still trying to figure out what you said, you know, the Internet of Things, what's an IO, you know what I mean? And they're still trying to digest and decipher everything that's said. They don't want to look stupid. They're already tired, you know, and honestly, people only have so many decisions every day, and that is a reality, you know.
Those meetings are what was the antithesis behind me learning how to work on a whiteboard. You know, it was a scenario where you'd sit there with your PowerPoint deck and you've got your, you know, your chart of numbers over here and you're trying to talk about technology and you got people pointing at different things. And ultimately, I would put a pin in those conversations very quickly and I'd head straight to the whiteboard because what I can draw in 5 minutes of somebody's time to depict what we're trying to put across to them versus what I could verbalize, you know, there's no comparison.
Right, right. And it also shows, sorry, but it also shows your expertise in the subject matter.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. The more you can simplify, the more you know or understand about the particular concept you're working with. And that's really a sign of, you know, when you found that there's that sort of intermediates disease where, you know, I'm better than this. I can do a million different things. Ooh, nice and shiny new thing versus a senior individual, because they'll turn less to those, you know, oh, let me send you a website. You should go here. You should check out this technology, that technology. They turn away from that and they spend more personalized time with you and they spend that time on the whiteboard and they draw things out for you. It's a real sign that you've kind of made that evolutionary jump with whoever you're with.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So look for the people who can whiteboard with you, who can draw that picture and help you understand. That's key. Also, I feel that we've pretty much illustrated that business analytics or data analytics at some level is probably pretty important for everybody. But I'm going to also say, pump the brakes on that a little bit and pump my spurious correlations. You need to stay away from, and I'm looking at it now, correlations like divorce rate in Maine correlates with per capita consumption of margarine. Yep, they're correlated. There you go. But do they really, really tell anything about each other? And, you know, business leaders need to be a little bit careful about that.
Well, sure. I think Sean to that was, you know, that was his thing about grow it as you need it. Like, don't just go, you know, to the ends of the earth. Start with something small. Build it from it.
Absolutely. All right, gentlemen, this has been a little bit longer today. It's been great. Love talking with you guys, and we will talk again in the near future. Enjoy the Cuyahoga.
don't, I hear you're on roasting sticks right now.
Don't swim in it. Don't swim in it. All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, guys.
We hope you've enjoyed the Technology Innovation and Growth Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or would just like more information, please feel free to reach out to us at podcast@tapintotech.com. If you have any questions for me, Sean Gange-Harris, my email is sgangeharris@tapintotech.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, and at www.tapintotech.com. Music provided today by www.bensound.com. Thank you for listening.